The following is a meeting with disciples with His Holiness Srila Satsarupa Das Goswami, given on February 17, 1995, at the Denver Temple.
I appreciate that some of you have come from long distances to come here. I think Radharaman, you came the furthest, maybe. You and me. You came from New York? Fly from New York?
Yeah, from New York. I come the farthest because I needed the most.
Krishna Bhajan, you look like a long time cowboy that you were born here. As soon as you begin to speak, they know. Hey, you're not from around here, are you? I say Americans are Anglophiles. They have some kind of sentimental attraction for English accents and English people.
They don't want to know how the Queen's doing.
As if you know. I haven't had a chance to show this to any group. It's a new book. It came out only a few days ago. And have any copies gotten here? No. So I can tell you a little bit what to look forward to. If you count Japa Reform Notebook and Jai. You arrived just in time. I'm making a book distribution pitch. New book. Have you seen it?
Oh, I haven't seen it. I heard it was going to be here.
Yeah. We don't have any quantity, do we? No. So the Japa Reform Notebook was the first book on just exclusively on Japa, and then another one. Begging for the Nectar of the Holy Name. So this is a book, the subject is Japa. And the cover is a little bit of a jest. Japa walks, Japa talks, but it's also serious. I start out in the introduction saying that often devotees invite devotees to take a Japa walk, but it usually turns into a talk instead. We don't seriously chant. But then what this consists of is me taking walks alone, and then coming back after the walk, which I took in Wicklow, Ireland, and writing down thoughts about Japa and also answering questions. Actually, the real thrust of the book is questions and answers about Japa. And I actually got questions from the devotees there in Ireland and a few other places. And so it's just like a exchange of questions and answers about Japa. And with a background of nature on the walks, I describe what the walks were like. That's the first half of the book. And then the second half of the book is a sort of easygoing commentary on Shikshastakam, one verse per day, also while included in on the walk mood. And the overall tone, I wasn't sure what it would be until I started out. And from my own point of view, Japa is a great joy, but it's also a great struggle to try to pay attention, and often I'm hard on myself. About my lax habits. So I said, well, is this writing going to be like that, real hard criticisms and so on, feeling depressed or what? But then somehow, just according to time and place and persons, the mood in this book is a sort of a realistic attempt to solve problems in Japa without so much moaning about our low state. And I think that came about because I took the role of instructing others, and they were giving me their problems. Really, you could say bad problems, not even chanting rounds or chanting in the car, my 16 rounds and things like that. So I had to encourage them. In the process, I was preaching to myself, but not in a sense that the love of God has been reached, Shudanam has been reached. But it's sort of, as I say, realistic handling of problems in japa. And somehow this walking helped me to do it in a way that I was satisfied that it will be interesting and, I hope, instructive for the devotees. So one of the special features is there's beautiful photography in here. When you get the book, I'm sure what you'll do, and I did it too, was look through all the pictures right away. But that's not the way to relish them. You can do that because that's the way we are. In fact, when I did that, I thought, why are all these pictures? There's too many. But then when I read it, they come up just at the right time while you're reading. They're all pictures of the walk. And they fit in very nicely. I was pleased, and I just... as the reader wants to find the next one and the next one along with his reading. So that makes the book quite a treat. There's numerous pictures, and they're beautifully done. Guru Seva Das, he took the pictures. And the printer, she took very good pictures also in that Castle Gregory prose poems, but the printer messed them up. But here, the printer did a wonderful job, and so all the pictures have come out very well. And it's a rather oversized book, a little unusual. On the back, it's got a, just in case someone wonders, well, what is this, japa walks? I never heard of any such a thing. We see Prabhupada taking a walk, and he's got his hand in his bead bag, and all the devotees also do. He would sometimes chant and sometimes talk. I make the point in the course of the book, that it's not that chanting ideally is done while walking. Chanting should be done sitting down, not being restless. But if we do fall asleep or are not able to, that would be one of the main reasons to get up. It's like a sort of a disqualification in the highest sense that you have to get up from just standing and chanting all your 16 rounds or chanting 24 hours in one place, like Haridas Thakur, or sit in one place and just chant. But better do that than not chant nicely. And it's just an additional thing to do. Even when I was doing this, I chanted in my room, I sat down, but then I went out for a walk also. So if you're going to walk, then while you're walking, you should chant. Well, you do anything, you should chant if possible. I wasn't trying to make walking as a substitute. So in the middle of today's class, we'll stop also and we'll do a chant around together. I was anxious about getting the books to Mayapur for the annual meetings, and no one was doing anything. So I just find at the last minute, I found different devotees who were rushing off to India. I guess you were involved, and I think one devotee from Denver took a box of these. He's already got them? Yeah. Oh, no one's breaking into them, huh? That's good.
You got them this morning?
Yeah. Otherwise, he'd go 25 books or something like that. Uh-huh. No, we've, what, 50 books? Did you say 50 pounds? That's more than 50, I hope. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the biggest time I have in a year for distributing books all over the world to the audience who wants to receive them. All right. Any questions about the book? Yeah.
But the pictures in look like the walk in Wicklow.
Yeah, Wicklow.
I have a question in regard to Prabhupada's japa. I'm always wondering, and I've never brought it to you before, in regards to Prabhupada chanting, walking, did he do his, I don't even know if he had a minimum amount for one, I guess there's two questions.
Yeah.
How many did he do a day?
You can ask me, I have my impression. You can also have someone like Hari Sori and Shruti Kirti, who spent so much time with Prabhupada. But my own impression, I also spent you know, time with him around the clock as his servant. I only can remember once he was once on a walk in Juhu Beach. He was walking and talking, and then he stopped, and he moved his counter beads, and he said, I have to make my quota, or something like that. And I was so surprised, because I'd never, that was a real exception. I never got the impression that, I never saw him moving his counter beads at other times. And he would chant early in the morning after his literary work, dictating, not for so long. On the walk, we didn't chant much at all. It's mostly it was talking or silence or some chanting. My answer is I don't know of him saying that he had a particular quota. It was such and such, and that he was concerned with it, like that. And we weren't. And another interesting point is we weren't concerned with it. You know, well, what is Prabhupada's quota? Nobody. I don't know if anyone even asked him. And he certainly did chant, though. He didn't have an attitude that I'm a Paramahamsa, I don't have beads. He always had his beads with him, made a point of it. One of his godbrothers did come to America and didn't have beads. And when asked, he said that he was on the Paramahamsa stage and he didn't have to have beads. But we told Prabhupada that. Well, he said that that's nonsense. Paramahamsa also chants his beads. Haridas Thakur chants on his beads. We always keep our beads. So he showed that example, always with his bead bag, and chanted, always reaching in and chanting in between things, in between talking to people, or while talking to people in pauses, he would murmur. And sometimes you would see him move the counter beads. But it was, I guess you could say it was a private thing. And that's why we didn't ask. It seemed like a private thing. We didn't want to ask our spiritual master, how many rounds are you chanting? As if it implied some kind of interrogation on our point. Are you doing your duty? And we held him in such high esteem that it didn't matter if he said 200 or if he said, I don't count or none or whatever. We know that he's always thinking of Krishna and he's always chanting on his beads. He said his spiritual master chanted 64 and prescribed that for his disciples. He prescribed 16 for his disciples.
Have you ever seen anything about his disciples as far as the 16 while on the Java walk or walking? Do you recommend sitting down?
You recommend sitting down? Now that's a... There are like two things, Prabhupada chanting and Prabhupada recommending. What is his own mood in chanting? And that we basically don't know. And then what is his mood towards our chanting? Another thing about, I thought somehow you were going to say something about the tape of Prabhupada chanting. I was once giving a seminar about japa, if you didn't agree, and I was talking about Prabhupada. And I was talking, we have to really chant with devotion and we have to hear and pay attention. It's so important to hear the words and to chant. And Prabhupada says, just hear, just hear. So one devotee, he said, it wasn't what he said, but he almost said it. So I'll say what I thought he almost said. He said, well, I've heard the tape of Prabhupada, and it doesn't sound like any big deal to him the way he's chanting. I mean, what is all this you're saying about how we have to get into chanting? He seems to just be chanting sort of matter of fact. And so I thought right away, you're reading into what you think you hear Prabhupada chanting on the japa. What do we know? What he's, you hear Ram, Ram, Hare Krishna, Hare, but what does it mean? We don't know the pure devotee's heart even when we hear his japa. If we're submissive, we do hear, and we can hear more and more. But to think, especially to think, I hear it and he seems to be, it seems to be just a routine activity. That's a great mistake. That tape is, of course, that's Prabhupada chanting in public at a Sunday feast. And he chanted differently in his alone also, when there wasn't a tape recorder there. But we're happy to have that tape also. I even wrote about that. I had some ambiguous feelings about that tape. And one godbrother was telling me, well, yes, he said, that's a very public thing that Prabhupada did. that tape. So you can't just take that as a japa tape of Prabhupada. But then another devotee, Kavi Chandra Maharaj, said he was there when that tape was made. It was his initiation. And he said it was so ecstatic. He said it was the best round I ever chanted. We were all chanting along with Prabhupada. So whether it's public or private, it's certainly vintage Prabhupada, and he's chanting on his beads for us. So what could be better that we can chant along with him? I have changing habits, but I've been following for a year or more that I chant 8 rounds with those. I listen to that in the ears. It's very nice. I time my rounds to one side, and it's just so nice to start every morning. So yeah, 2 different things. Prabhupada's chanting, and then he wasn't like Haridas Thakur sitting all alone and chanting. He didn't give us that example. He gave us the example of spreading the holy name all over. He was active, he was preaching, but what was he preaching? He was preaching that everyone should chant Hare Krishna. You could say he sacrificed his sitting and relishing the holy name in order to give it to others, but he also was always chanting. And for us, he recommended also that we should be active and we should preach, but we should be very attentive to our chanting. It's the most important thing of all the things we do every day is to chant at least 16 rounds. That's the minimum. Perhaps my favorite thing, I just heard it yesterday or the day before yesterday. It's Mayapur 1973 lecture, and Prabhupada starts talking about how we have to chant. He quotes Bhagavad Gita, Tesham Satata Yuktanam Bhajatam Pritti Purvakam. He starts talking about the meaning of Pritti, or devotion. That Krishna will instruct someone who chants, who worships him with devotion. And that's the tape where he says, when you chant, it's not this Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, but with Pritti, with love. And then again, he does that satiric imitation, which is so heavy to hear him, that you think he was so high above us, he wasn't aware that we did that garbled chanting, but he could hear it all around him. And sometimes Prabhupada would be in his room, and he would send his servant out, and they would go to the next room and says, "Who's chanting in here? Prabhupada said stop chanting." And the body would think, "What's the matter? Doesn't he like to hear the holy names?" And Prabhupada wouldn't like to hear devotees chanting, because he was doing something else. But maybe also it was the way what he was hearing. So how we were chanting, and he wanted us to be chanting with Pritti. So that's a real essential instruction about how he wants us to chant. Now how you do that you have to practice and strive for, to chant with love, not to chant mechanically or inattentively. So I think he placed great emphasis on our chanting 16 rounds and then filling our day with all other activities, which also involve giving the chanting to others. And that's a kind of kirtan also. Yeah.
Some time ago, Indrajimna Swami had a really bad throat condition in Mayapur, and he was chanting his rounds, but not actually chanting. Yeah? He was chanting them in his mind. He'd be sitting in the temple and going like this, yeah? But obviously he couldn't speak at all. So under those circumstances, I mean, those kind of circumstances, I mean, it's okay to chant in the mind.
Sure.
So then the question would be, if he's doing that, then is chanting in the mind as effective as chanting out loud?
In an absolute sense, you could say it is. But it's very difficult to do that because the mind has got all these noises of its own. So without making any vibration to distinguish the holy name and pay attention to it, it amounts to a kind of silent meditation on the holy name. You have to have a lot of powers of attention and devotion. So it's not we don't recommend it, or Prabhupada doesn't recommend it, because the sound vibration immediately breaks the static of the mind and forces the mind to pay attention. So we should be careful not to make an absolute judgment that anybody who ever chanted in his mind was being inattentive. However, also in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita by Sanatana Goswami, there's kind of a debate discussion about it. And this person, Gopakumar, he goes all over the place and visits different planets and everything. And at one time he's with some gyanis, and they recommend silent meditation and silent thinking of Krishna. They're not Mayavadis. So then he meets up with some bhaktas, and it's Sanatana Goswami himself. He gives a discourse on the superiority of making the sound vibration. And one main point he makes is that others can benefit, and otherwise you can benefit yourself. But when you chant, others can benefit out loud. And he recommends that chanting should be done by making a sound vibration. So we just follow that example. Although there may be examples of previous acharyas who chanted silently. Let me take some questions that you've asked. Well, this is a nice topic too. This is a question from Krishna Bhajan. In the class here recently, it was stated that Maharaj Priyavrata, as the ruler of this world of seven, was the ruler of this world of seven islands. In the purport, Prabhupada says that the seven islands are still current as America, Asia, Europe, Africa, Australia, and the North and South Poles. I looked up seven islands on the Prabhupada database and found that in a fourth canto purport, Prabhupada also described the seven islands as the continents, although the list was different. Elsewhere in the Bhagavatam, these seven islands seem to be accepted as the seven dvipas of Bhumandala, starting with the fifth canto onwards, and this is how Sataput refers to them. Maharaj Priyavrata was actually the king of Bhumandala, and his chariot wheels were what divided the plain of Bhumandala into seven islands. My question is this. Is Srila Prabhupada in his third and fourth canto purports giving a simple explanation of the seven islands in terms the reader can relate to, leaving aside discussion of the actual higher realms of the greater earth of Bhumandala until the fifth canto, when the topic is dealt with in full detail? If so, is this an example of the guru first of all saying the object is a snake and later saying that it is a rope, and in each case the disciple accepts and believes what the guru is saying? Could you comment on the kinds of circumstances in which a guru might employ such a tactic and the reasons for his using this mechanism, even if the example I have given does not really fall into this category? Do you have any personal recollection of Srila Prabhupada first saying something was one thing and then later saying it was something else, and the disciple accepted what he said in both cases? I think of a light example where this devotee, Umapati, met Prabhupada in San Francisco, and Prabhupada said, "You look like you're eating a lot, you should eat less." And he said, "Well, Prabhupada in New York, you told me to eat more." And Prabhupada said, "So did you do what I said then?" "Yes," he said, "so I'll now do what I say now." So there, according to time and place, the spiritual master changed his instruction, but it was an appropriate one. And I think additional questions are, why does he do this? He does this. Why does he do it? And I think the bottom line in the discussion is, don't think he's ever wrong. He's always trying to preach surrender to Krishna. I appreciate that for Prabhupada, the whole universe and all the phenomena in it serve as possible arguments and evidence to be used one way or another. His perfection is that he's always surrendered and preaching Krishna consciousness. So there's no mistake. If we place too much importance on what we call the facts, I just want the facts, ma'am, the old police sergeant always used to say, we just want the facts. And that's what a police investigator wants, or a scientist. But the facts are changeable, and the truth of surrender to Krishna is eternally true. And that's what the guru is talking about. There's a letter I thought of in connection with your question. which deals with both things, which deals with scientific statements, how to understand science, and also what is the ultimate purpose of all our inquiries. This is a letter to a devotee named Madhava, who was one of the BI scientists at that time. In 1976, Prabhupada wrote him, regarding details of the universe, be satisfied by reading only Bhagavatam. What is the use of reading other books? You are not going there. Some portion of the earth is flat. When you stand in any place, you see flat. So for us, to some extent, it appears flat, but it is round. Simply keep faith that whatever we describe, that is a fact. After all, we are an insignificant creature in the universe, so whether you take the modern scientists or Sukadeva Goswami, it is inconceivable. It is best to keep faith in Sukadeva Goswami, because actually our only business is to go back home, back to Godhead. So whether Sukadeva Goswami or the modern scientists are right or wrong, it is nothing interesting to us. We want to go back home, back to Godhead. Yanti man, yajinopi mam. P.S. Bhartavarsha in fifth canto refers to the whole earth. So this may be a little surprising and even disappointing to devotees who are very, very scientific-minded, that Prabhupada says they want to establish, well, are the scientists right, or is what the Bhagavatam says right, and let's get it straight. So we either will go along with what the scientists are saying and understand it that way, or if we have to defy them, then we have to know it. So Prabhupada is saying he's not particularly interested who is right or not. Sukadeva may say something. So, well, is Sukadeva, is he talking about what's actually out there? Or are the scientists actually saying it? So he's saying, whatever Sukadeva is saying, by hearing him, we'll go back to Godhead. And by hearing the scientists, we won't. So you'll die and you'll say, they were right about the moon. I always knew it. I knew that Bhagavatam was off. And then you'll go to the moon, or you'll be born a scientist in the material world and suffer like anything. And if you die thinking of Krishna, it won't matter what you hear later about the moon or not. So that letter, by the way, if you want the more details, it's 3 October 1976. To Madhava. So, I guess I said everything I wanted to about that. Changing instructions and not getting disturbed by analogies. Analogies are just analogies to try to bring the absolute truth into clear view for us. If they don't work, then take another one. This is a simple example of Prabhupada's lecturing 1965 in Mishra's ashram with some lady is there interrupting him. And he's saying that it wasn't even an example, it's just a fact. He says there's a disease where you see two objects. He said, you actually see one, but you see it as two. It's myopia. And the lady says, no, myopia is that farsightedness? Short-sighted.
You can see good up
front. Yeah. So he says, maybe. He said, maybe myopia, that is something different than he said. But it is, one object is seen as two. So he didn't know the word. He said it's a word that was different, scientific mistake, you could say. So he wasn't ashamed to admit it. But also, even in things that might involve analogies, if you find something wrong with the analogy, then he would say the same thing. Well, all right, then take another analogy. But the thing is, Krishna is very beautiful, and more beautiful than we can imagine. He's as beautiful as a blue lotus. Someone would say, well, actually, Swamiji, the blue lotuses, they turn bad very soon, and they're really not so beautiful. All right, then what do you think is beautiful? Once Prabhupada said to a lower east side, he said, imagine a whole room of LSD. He said, he said, Krishna is much more than that, even. So the analogies are to make you see what we cannot see otherwise, but the fact is absolute. And I think we all sometimes can really get disturbed with analogies. I remember there was an analogy, he said, how a man, there's no such thing as shortage in the world, and man just mismanages everything. So you never see a bird that starves to death. There's no example of a bird starving to death. That ticked off something in my mind. First, why? I think birds starve to death. Why is he saying that? I used to think about it a lot. It's just silly. most cases, he said that he also, once his spiritual master said, kill the snake, and he thought about that for years afterwards. Why did Guru Maharaj say that the snake should be killed? The sadhu is nonviolent. And then he read in the Bhagavatam that even a sadhu is happy when a snake is killed. So that's an example of later, your disturbance is cleared up. And for someone, so you shouldn't have been disturbed. You should have had faith all along and understood, eventually I'll understand this. Or it may be that the analogy isn't so perfect materially, and you shouldn't weigh too much, expect too much out of it. It's just a way to focus the mind on Krishna. And then there's also things he says like, I've described this in that book, Prabhupada Appreciation, like he says, women are not intelligent, things like this. These things can, or a man didn't go to the moon. Some single thing, a devotee can just work at it and work at it. It's like chewing the inside of your mouth or something, you know, some habit until you just cause yourself some real harm. You have to be careful not to become doubtful over some item that we cannot understand right now and eventually we'll understand. Okay, we'll do another one. In your book, All Things Fail Without Krishna, when you speak of the no frivolous sports, does the Sufi circle dancing, which seems to have Krishna dances in it, apply? And what about deep sea snorkeling? So, from time to time I worry about that chapter. I think about it and say, boy, you really were so conservative and so strict. You said no sports. What are the devotees going to say? And that book, by the way, is already sold out, and they're printing another edition. And some devotees, like the 108 band and the Shringa, and some devotees in Boston, they like to give them out at concerts and everything because of the timeliness. But I think about, wow, some of those chapters are really strict, like the one that says no frivolous sports. And but it's not a problem for me. I don't want to be too conservative, but Prabhupada said no frivolous sports, and he wrote it on his platform, on his statement in the temple. So the sport activity, any activity, if we do something, we should be thinking of Krishna while we do it. And if you do something that's not Krishna conscious, that's another thing. If you feel that sometimes I have to do some things that aren't Krishna conscious, well, that's arguable whether you should be doing it, but at least don't claim that it's, well, since I'm doing it, it is Krishna conscious. So I don't see how Sufi circle dancing would be Krishna conscious. When you Prabhupada used to say, this dancing is not ballroom dancing. He said it may look like ordinary dancing, but it's completely different, because we're dancing for the deity and before Krishna and so on. Lord Chaitanya danced, and he defended his dancing when the Mayavadi sannyasi said, sannyasis don't dance and sing. And he did dance, and he never stopped dancing. Krishna dances. There's Krishna conscious dancing, and then why should we dance with the Sufis, who are not even theists? If in some religious gathering people are worshiping God and they're dancing, that can be also like a part of kirtan dancing, and even Sufi dancing. I mean, I don't want to make a specific judgment on them. But there's so many things that may lead up to Krishna consciousness, and that's all right. Sufi dancing is not ballroom dancing, but why should we go back to that? When we have, why should a devotee especially go back to baseball and Sufi dancing deep sea snorkeling. There may be somebody who comes to Krishna consciousness. He said, "When I, how I think of God when I do these things and so on." But then eventually, when he's practicing Krishna consciousness, he'll want to do things that are only very Krishna conscious. So having said this, it probably still is within the realm of opinion. There may be some Vaishnavas who do these things in a Krishna conscious way, and I don't want to make a judgment on them. So take it as my opinion. But it's an opinion that has some evidence from Prabhupada, who said, no frivolous sports.
Guru, she put that in the regulative principles when you first wrote that down.
Yeah.
Is it that serious?
Well, where was it? What was that?
Was it 26 Second Avenue?
Yeah, do you remember the particular...
No gambling or frivolous sports.
Yeah, like that. Oh, it was like lumped in with gambling or frivolous sports. Yeah.
Idle.
Yeah. Prajalpa. Yeah. Yeah, it's really heavy in one sense. Like he went, I'm just cautious because some devotees may do those things, and I don't want to sit here and talk about, and say, well, they say, so-and-so Maharaj, he does this. Now what am I going to say? I can't judge on somebody's consciousness who may do those things. But, I remember he would walk in the park, and he, Cheviot Hills Park, it's a golf course. He'd see them playing golf, and he'd say, simply wasting time. He said, we are thinking in so many ways how to save time, and they're always thinking how to waste time with this ball and that ball. He just saw them all as a waste of time. So many sports involve a ball and putting the ball into the hole or knocking the ball back and forth and hitting the ball over the fence, kicking the ball, rolling the ball, billiard ball. And so Prabhupada, he just saw it all as just wasting time. And that was his point of view. But he didn't like to see us doing that when we could be working for Krishna, reading or chanting, distributing Bhakti Guided magazine, and editing, cooking, deity worship. What is this? You have time for this?
There's a little more liberality with Grokul.
Yeah. Well, yeah. They don't have the taste, and they don't have the seriousness. It's part of their foolishness of youth. Youth has so many wonderful advantages over old age, sensually, and in terms of strength and enthusiasm of physical spirit and so on. But they tend to be foolish and waste time. And if you tell them don't waste time, they'll think that you're just a... being too restrictive, because they like want to do what's fun, and they don't have the gravity or the taste of Krishna consciousness. Children who do, they're not interested in sports. Like the great children of Mahabhagavats and everything. He was one who did not even like to go. He was one who from his childhood would play with dolls of Krishna, and when his mother called him to eat, he would not want to go. Let's not give the example of Krishna. He's special. Krishna plays, throws balls back and forth, fruits, and plays and wrestles with his friends. When we can go there, then we can do that. Because Krishna, it's just Krishna. It's not like, they have teams and they're really interested. They're forgetting Krishna for a minute. But everything is that you're either on Krishna's side or you're against Krishna. But it's just, let's defeat Krishna or let's help Krishna defeat the others, and look at Krishna, and be with Krishna, and run and play. Spiritual life, when we say no sports, no frivolous sports, it doesn't mean that we're dry, like our picture of the impersonal Vedantist who's always studying. I saw the film the other day, that 1959 Bengali film, Nimai of Nilachala, or Nimai of Navadvip, and the other one. And there's one scene where the devotees, Lord Chaitanya's out with kirtan, and they're dancing, chanting so melodiously. And so they're moving, and you could say they're exercising, dancing, and they're so blissful. And then indoors, shut up in his little room, is Sarvabhauma, who's at that time, he's not converted to a devotee. And he's looking at these, what do you call them? Pieces of
parchments
with the Vedanta Sutra on it. And he hears, Hare Krishna. And he gets angry and he just keeps studying. And so that's the picture of the, you know, the dry Vedantist. And the devotees are outside having a blissful time. But what are they doing? Not having frivolous sports. We're not dry, but we're not wasting time. Question. In college, I was taught different methods to appreciate poetry. I know that you've also studied different styles of poetry. Is there advice you could give us as to how we could increase our appreciation of your poetry? I don't think I've ever been asked this question, but I thought it was a very interesting and relevant question, especially for this meeting, because this is a disciples' meeting, a meeting of myself and yourselves. And I could see from your point of view, or the point of view of a disciple, the seriousness of this question. Since I often write in poetry, maybe some of you have trouble relating to it or would like to understand why I'm doing this and or how better to appreciate it as instruction or inspiration in Krishna consciousness, which is the reason the question is asked. It's interesting for me to answer because I am involved in poetry, and So it raised many different responses for me. I'm not exactly sure what, how far to go in trying to advise you on this. For example, since I spend so much time in my service in writing in general, whether poetry or prose, sometimes devotees have asked me, why don't I teach a writing course? And I've never thought to do it, or I thought to do it, but I always decide not to, because I'm not interested in teaching devotees to become writers. That's an incidental thing if somebody wants to develop that service. But then at the last Gita Nagari seminar, I taught the Bhagavad Gita verses and then involved the students in writing our responses and using many of the methods that I use in free writing and so on. And so I wasn't teaching them writing, and I even explicitly told them that I'm not teaching you to become writers, but we're using writing, because it's a powerful instrument, to help us free our thoughts and to express what we were doing is, we were trying to see special verses where Krishna speaks to us in the Bhagavad Gita, and then I gave them writing assignments, like, how do you respond to this verse? And I just write down what you really feel about this. And then I would read their papers and read it back to them. It became a kind of writing course of a sort, and everyone liked it, and I liked it. So it took me years to actually do something with writing with devotees, although I don't intend to do it right away again either, but mainly because it was such a workload for me to read all the papers and get right back to them by the next class. But maybe someday poetry is even further removed. It's a more esoteric art in writing. And but I think I at least, so to get you to appreciate poetry is sort of questionable. Why should I do that? I never thought of it, but this is a pertinent question, that if you don't appreciate poetry at all, or the kind of poetry I write as a genre, then maybe I should help you, or at least I should answer this question. To help devotees to appreciate my writing of poetry, and here we have this a new book I published of poetry. So first I have some attitudes as to how you should approach these books. I know some devotees have even frankly told me that I don't like your poetry, compared to the other things you write. I don't understand what you. I don't understand many of the things that you write in the poems. So I'm aware of that. So one thing you have to appreciate: the poetry is not just a transference of the information of the doctrine, the doctrines in Krishna consciousness, but has more to do with the way things are said. It's an art of saying it. Otherwise, it's not poetry. Of course, in Krishna consciousness, the message has to be parampara, but it has to do, as I say, more with something other than just the philosophy or the information itself. But there's a certain art. Now, another thing with my poetry is modern poetry. It's modern American English, but modern poetry in almost all the languages in the world today, or what we could call it, the way poetry is written by poets all over the world nowadays, it's different than poetry used to be. I know some devotees like to write poetry, and they use rhyme and meter, and there's nothing wrong with that. But mostly poetry is not written in rhyme and meter. There's one book that I look at each year. It's called the best American Poetry of 1993, 1994. Each year, it's a collection that Macmillan puts out. And I was reading the introduction of the latest one, and they said that somebody they have some kind of computer thing that you can run to find how many rhymes. So they said the total rhymes in this volume is one. There's one rhyme. So, because rhyme is, there's something artificial about having to make one line chime or rhyme with the previous one, at least as it's felt in modern or consciousness. So anyway, since I write in that way, and you're trying to appreciate my poetry, don't expect that. That would be one thing. Why doesn't it rhyme? Or why doesn't it have some special meter? What poetry emphasizes is especially a voice, of authenticity, a real person speaking, not just something that's official, but is truthful in the most private sense of the real cutting edge of honesty. So poetry is like that. So poetry is very important, actually, in culture, because if when poetry fulfills that function, that you always have a voice of the poet he does not belong to any system, but he speaks the truth. Now, we belong to the system of Krishna consciousness, but within that, we try to speak the truth. There's one devotee, I'll get to that point later. Also, a thing about, once a devotee questioned something I wrote in a poem, and I understood that he wasn't appreciating it as poetry, but he was just looking at it as a doctrinal statement, and how could this pass as something that we would present to everyone as being at all times Krishna consciousness. So I said, well, poetry expresses moods. Sometimes a poem may be sad, and it would be like sadder than we usually expect somebody to be in Krishna consciousness, but people have moments like that. And sometimes a poem may be very happy. And so you could say it's like excessive to overall consciousness or what we want to present as normal consciousness. But poems present moods. And this is not just modern, but also the six Goswamis and so on. Sometimes, like in Saranagati, the mood is despair. Oh, but I thought devotees were jolly. Why is he despair? Well, sometimes we feel like that. So the moods are expressed, whereas in philosophy, it's not so much that a mood would be expressed. So to appreciate poems, you don't get thrown off that a particular mood was expressed and just try to compare it exactly to the Siddhanta and say, well, I thought a devotee wasn't supposed to think like this at any time ever. Well, we do think like that from time to time. And poems, they come out with it. that's their allegiance to things that actually happen, to things that they're actually seeing in consciousness. Another comment is that as one who writes poetry, there's very little poetry written in ISKCON today compared to other things that are done. One devotee even told me when I published a book, it was over 10 years ago, and he didn't like it just because it was poetry, and he said he thought that poetry in general is a sign, when poetry is written, it's a sign of decadence in a society. It's like, it sounds like a Marxist attitude or something, that, you know, people should always be busy in the farm or in the factory or something. And if anybody's writing poetry, it's like the sign that somebody isn't working, he's having these decadent activities. Sometimes even poetry is called that, it's called a vice. Contrary to that criticism, poetry has a very honored place in Vaishnava tradition. Prabhupada says all the poets, all the Vaishnavas are poets. It's one of the 26 qualities of a devotee to be a poet. Don't be mundane, be a poet. Think in metaphors, be poetical. Appreciate Krishna, you have to be poet. So that's not a valid criticism. I think that all devotees won't like poetry. Those who are themselves poet-like, who like to read poetry, feel language, and so on, like to play with words, and of a certain temperament, will like poetry. So that's granted. One could say also then, if that's true, and it is true, that poetry is least popular in the bookstores, poetry, although it's, they say it's getting more popular, but compared to fiction and nonfiction and so on, poetry is not very popular. So people who write poetry, they just do it because they love it and they feel it says things that other writing doesn't say, but it's not the most popular kind of writing. But I also love it. I feel it does things that other writing doesn't do, so I write. And I don't care if these books don't sell as well as other books, even if mine, or even if people don't understand it. I hope that eventually they will understand. I just can't not write poetry because a lot of people don't like it, or even my disciples don't understand it. It's too important to me. That's why I like this question, because something that's so important and personal to me, a disciple is saying, well, you know, what is this? This world that you're in of poetry, since it's your world and we're your disciples, maybe we should get into it. How can we appreciate it better? I think also to not be thrown off by poetry, you have to expect that thought moves very quickly in poetry. It doesn't move in a logical progression. It can just move real fast. Just see the way fish move, they go this way and then suddenly they're going that way. Because the mind goes like that. And so the poetry tunes into the flow of the mind. Sometimes it moves very quickly. And if you're looking for, like in an essay, first you make point A, then you make point B, and therefore, giving five examples and six sub-arguments, then they can make the next statement. But poetry doesn't have to follow that. It follows the actual way that the mind turns. And it tends to be improvisational. There was one line a poet made about his own poetry. He said, shall I tell the truth or shall I try to make sense? So generally, we try to make sense out of what's going on and say, well, this is what it is, or this is who I am. But the truth is that things don't make sense to us if we really face up to our actual experience of what's going on, of life. And so sometimes poetry is like that. It's the truth, but it doesn't make for a neat package, or it doesn't even make sense. Now, again, in Krishna consciousness, a poem should make sense. But it doesn't have to, everything doesn't have to be in terms of a structure tied in neatly, that the beginning said this, promised this, and then the middle said this, and the end did this. But more like moments of life, the way they're actually experienced. So without being aware of these things, that might be a reason that you read a poem and you scratch your head and say, even one of my poems, and say, you know, well, what was that? Why he started off here and he ended up here? And yeah, that was Krishna conscious, but I don't get it, or I don't see exactly what it was. So it's partly you do have to learn the language of poetry. Now, what I'd like to do is give a few examples by reading a couple of my poems and then pointing out what was going on. And I'm going to read a couple of poems of a very good poet also who's not a devotee. Let's see, there's also a statement. I just got a letter, a fax letter, somebody. Well, it just shows that somebody does appreciate. Some devotees do like the poetry. Just like in the material world, only a few people relatively like poetry. Like in Among Friends, like 90% of the letters I get, people like it. What they like is the letters section. We really like this section very much. But there are a few people who like the poetry, and they really like it. So I try to... I'm not going to stop writing letter selections, but I'm not going to stop the poetry either. All right, let me do this little poetry class thing. To try to explain to you why some odd collection of lines can be passed off as a poem, or what I think makes a poem. Of course, there's line division, too. And when you read out loud, you can't appreciate that. So that's we say it's an art. That's a visual thing. It's like a painting almost. It's optical. That it looks pleasing. The way instead of, you know, going to the end of each line all the time, reading a book, you have this different shape, and the way the lines are divided, it's hard to say what it is. It's one of those things that you just can't describe. You can't exactly describe music or color, why they're pleasing, but they certainly are. So line division. There's not exactly a science as to why you do it. I think a lot of people, they can never get out of the idea that poetry has to be rhymed, it has to be metered, and they just can't figure out, you know, why the heck did he divide it here? And maybe a poet really can't always say, but it's a very lovely thing to read the divided line form of a poem. Okay. Having said all this, granted, there's a lot of bogus bluff in the name of modern poetry, certainly, and so much modern art, but we always try to avoid that. This is part of a series. This book is divided into different sections, and I think the best section, as far as the poetry, is the second section called The Wind in the Chimney. It was written in Castle Gregory, Ireland, and I like the poems in that section better. I like the third section also. It's like prose and poetry. I very much like to pass from prose into poetry and back to prose again. That's about India. And then the poems called Serious Business, written while preaching lectures in Ireland. They're like the freest poems. The improvisation really gets quite free there. That's my estimation of these different. I felt that the first section was the least strong in the book. So here's one called Breathe by the Ocean. One time a store owner in Tucson became enraged and grabbed my danda from my hand. Calling me Kami, he smashed me on the head with it and broke it. I wasn't hurt, except inside. I stopped the policeman and told him. He told me to ride on the back of his motorcycle. Then he dropped me off and said, I'll be back later and you can press charges. Forget it, he never came. I want to go outside now and walk and breathe by the ocean. I'm not bitter, but pleased and very lucky. So on the surface, this is just an anecdote or a memory, and then there's three lines at the end, which are different than that. But the three lines sort of turn it into a poem, plus the context of all these poems grouped together, that I was alone by the ocean and spending a lot of time chanting, and while doing that, from time to time, different things were coming up, and it was a healing process facing different things that had happened in life, and they just come up sometimes, not that you plan to, and you see them for what they are, and in this case, something painful about life, how ugly life is, but you were so fortunate to be a devotee, and even to be beat for being a devotee, you were fortunate, and so it's painful. It was painful then, it's painful now to remember it, but this is what comes from, this is a good result of spending time alone and chanting, that from time to time, different things get adjusted within yourself. You could say it's a kind of, this is our therapy, Krishna conscious therapy, is not to go to a psychiatrist, but to chant Hare Krishna, and your whole life gets adjusted for you by the holy name. And so this came, and I saw it, and I felt it, and then he, as a poet, the poetry then says, I'm not bitter, but I'm pleased and very lucky. So I'm explaining how that's a poetic experience. Poetry readers have to be very sensitive. They have to work a lot harder than other readers. And the beauty of it is the poet, he doesn't like just spoon-feed them stuff. He doesn't hit them on the head with it. But he says it, and they're right there, and they pick it up. And it's just the nicest kind of, most sensitive kind of communication. Sometimes it takes rereading. It usually does. And poetry stands up better with rereading than other books. You can read them again and again because they're like that. And here's another within that piece on India where it was prose and poetry mixed together. There's one, just a few lines. I'll read the whole page. First the prose, and then I'll tell you when it changes. I don't like loose talk among devotees. I mean, I don't like it when they cheaply say they want to write poems or sing songs in the spiritual world. I think, bosh. You can't even be a humble soul and serve Vaishnavas, what to speak of contemplating what kind of sash you'll wear on your hips when you're a gopi. Yeah, come down, come down. Look us in the eye. Or if you look at the floor, then tell us why. And then the poem lines. I say, please, please, give us nakedness of spirit. It is such a relief from pompousness. Don't be a male hero or a pretentious pig. Better an honest guy or even a lamp post. Just a boring, ordinary, but utterly true person or thing. So this is like, these last lines, that's like a manifesto in poem lines of what I was saying poetry is. It's that, you know, trying to throw off all the pretense and say the truth, whether it's official, whether it is the official truth or not, and to be authentic. So poetry has a, when you practice writing poetry, it's not just to make pretty ornate lines that rhyme or don't rhyme, but it's this effort to unlock these secrets and to make a kind of music. It may not be necessary for me to read the, if this was a writing class, I'd read the other poetry. Let me see if I want to do it or not. These poems are very lovely. And that I wrote a note that this poem is only a step before God consciousness. Okay, I think I will read it. This is by a poet called Mary Oliver, whose poetry has won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. She writes a lot about nature. So this is a poem, this is about poetry, actually. So I think I can introduce it, since we're appreciating my poetry, and I'm trying to tell you what poetry is, the way it's written. Nowadays, the poem is called Work. How beautiful this morning was pasture pond. It had lain in the dark all night, catching the rain on its broad back. All day I work with the linen of words and the pins of punctuation. All day I hang out over a desk, grinding my teeth, staring. Then I sleep. Then I come out of the house, even before the sun is up, and walk back through the pine woods to pasture pond. Now, one thing that poetry is metaphor. So here, for example, what makes this a poem, among other things, is that the pond is described as catching the rain on its broad back. So this is an image. And Vaishnava literature is filled with metaphor all the time, especially when we talk about rasa, every inch of the way is practically Krishna is compared to something. Metaphor means you compare something to something else. Although some poetry doesn't do this. The Japanese haiku doesn't like it. But we, for Vaishnavas, we use punctuation. And so the thing about this poem is that it's telling about the life of the poet, which which is to stay indoors and to work, try to make it come out right, write it again, choose the right words. Poems are earned, they're lived. And poets have to qualify themselves to write a poem. So it's a lot of hard work, at least the way this poet is describing her efforts. And she uses more metaphors, what it's like. But then when she goes outdoor, she sees nature as a poem in itself, you know, better than, it's a discovery. This shows how a poet works, and nature itself is the perfect poem. And I thought it was just a couple of steps before God consciousness that if the next thing you would realize would be that, why is the pond what it is, better than any poem that you could write? Because it comes from God. So that's all I'll read. And that's all I have of that on that topic. Is there any questions? Yeah.
How, in your writing, would the poetry, writing poetry, differ from free writing? When you actually are enjoying it?
Not much, except that it does. It is the short lines. If you look like in a dictionary or encyclopedia of literature for definitions of what free verse is, there's not much you can say about it, or you start making rules for it. So usually they'll say, you know, it doesn't have any rules. But that there's one definition. It just says, well, when the print is not doesn't go to the end of the page, then it's poetry. So when it's so especially when you, well, of course, if you just have some ordinary manual about how to operate a typewriter, you can put it in divided lines. It won't read like a poem. So. But what you're talking about, free writing, it gets very close. It is poetry. Yeah.
It seems like in the section Vrindavan, you flow.
Yeah.
Flows right into the.
So there's hardly, there's poetry. Often not much difference.
Yeah.
And I have one friend I went to college with, and we used to keep in touch, and he's been a poet his whole life. And then we got in touch again. I was telling him my poetry. And he was making critiques of it. He thought I didn't work enough on it. He said, but actually, he used to read among friends. He said, when you write in the prose in your diary, your travel diary, he said, I think that's your best poetry, he said, and every time you write, it's poetry. He said, we have this prejudice that poetry means that you have to divide the lines. He said, but actually, poetry means this also. So in a larger sense, even when you don't divide the lines, it's poetry. It's sometimes called prose poem.
Getting to that stark naked revelation of truth, you know, it's just kind of what you're describing. Out of your writing will be directed towards uplifting your disciples and your readers, you know,
yeah.
Helping them advance in Christian consciousness.
Right.
It seems that sometimes with your poetry, it's not always so evident that that's the motivation there. It's more like your expressions.
Yeah, that's a good question. Except that something is being conveyed there, too. Like at the one extreme, you have propaganda. I wrote something maybe recently about that I wanted to get beyond writing for an audience. So one of my disciples wrote me, and he's interested in doing some writing. He said, I can't understand this. He said, when I ever do attempt to write, I'm always trying to think of the audience. Is it the Indian Life members? Is it the Africans? And I have to think of them and write to them. So I wrote back and I assured him that what he was doing is right. He should think of the audience. Partly I could see that telling him anything else was inappropriate for what he was trying to do. But what he was trying to do is one kind of writing, and it's like you could call it propaganda. Propaganda can also develop into an art, the art of persuasion by propaganda. Just like in this country, Thomas Paine? He wrote some pamphlets that are attributed for being like, you know, part of the causes of the American Revolution. And so they were like inciting people to action. So that's propaganda. And then the other end, you could say self-expression. A person is just saying how he feels, and he's really not trying to motivate anybody else to do anything. He's just saying, this is how I feel. And yet, that has an effect that can also persuade people and move people. Because people, they're getting enough propaganda all the time. Do this, do this. And somebody's really heavy. If you don't do this, you know, I'm going to cause some violence on you. Or somebody else is doing it more tricky. You say, well, why don't you do this? But he's actually trying in every way to get that person to do something. So somebody who's not really trying to do that, you know, it's like a relief. There's somebody who's just saying something. I'm a person.
and this is how I feel. And you think, boy, what a relief. Here's a person who's not trying to put a trip on me. Now, there's nothing wrong with putting a trip on people if it's to make them Krishna conscious. But, so therefore, I'm saying that this apparently non-persuasive writing can be very good preaching for people who don't want to hear that other way anymore. And it moves, and there's a connection, and you know, you feel this as a soul-to-soul communication. Writing is about communication. So when you very deliberately try to communicate and use all your conscious skills to send messages, subliminal messages, and so on, you can do it, but you can also do it by just not getting into that. And just it's tricky that if you're actually just writing for yourself. But like myself, even when I'm writing, as much as it seems I'm just writing for myself, I'm always aware that I am going to I'm trying to share it. But I've developed it to a point where I don't feel that it's hypocritical. I can almost do both at the same time. But if I'm not careful, I can fall into just pretending to speak to myself, but actually thinking I'm speaking to somebody else. What I'm trying to convey is it's not like you think it is, not or that you may think it is. That the poetry, because it's not telling disciples that this is what Prabhupada said and you should chant 16 rounds, just explicitly saying like that. I'm still trying to convey those things, but I'm trying to convey something else that... I also feel a need to do this to establish honesty in our relationship. You know, in ISKCON we've been through so much about... the gurus and the disciples and the society is always scrutinizing it. Whether there's any bluffing element, is the guru, is he actually elevated, or is he pretending to just take a role to convey, is the relationship, is there something under it that's kind of false? We're pretending we're his disciples, he's pretending that he's more advanced than us, and we go through this whole thing and we worship him and everything. Is it actually true, or is it just the tradition? So, we have been guilty of practicing some false things, and so I'm trying to be myself, trying to do that service, but to do it very honestly without pretension. So that means I try to really, like, for my disciples, say, you know, this is who I really am, this is what I actually think. And so that they'll know more and more, yeah, he's honest, we know who he is, and this, he is who he says he is, and because he writes his heart out. So it's a way of keeping up trust and keeping honest. And then by transference, it should make you honest, too. And if I'm you know, willing to say these things and to know myself and think it's valuable, then you should also. Again, not that you should write poetry, but that you should also be able to think, to face yourself, and to do similar a process. Someone had a hand. Oh.
I have so many positive impressions about your writing, it's hard to say them all, but I was in that writing class that you were discussing. It was quite a unique experience. I mean, there were... You were reading back many of the devotees' writings, and they sounded very true and eloquent. And
yeah.
This is very good. It was very straightforward and honest. And
yeah, it was quite a thing. It's not like, you know, I'm the artist and you should appreciate my writing. But in that context, everyone was pouring out and they were writing. What were they writing about? Like, they were just focused on Bhagavad Gita, but all kinds of things. It was really good.
I just want to make another point. Yeah.
Go ahead.
It seems, for myself, reading something in the first person is always more appealing. And in many ways, you invite us into your places, into your retreats, and we're with you on your walks. It just feels much more like a relationship in the writing. It's a type of, you know, even though we're very far apart, we feel some sort of relationship. Huh. Now he's walking to the beach, now he's sitting in his cabin, and he's admitting that he's thinking about the Brooklyn Dodgers lineup. And we thought that was very... very honest, because we do also, you know, our minds are very active in many ways that we sometimes feel embarrassed about.
Mm.
But it's, like you said, it is a very, in the first person, is very honest. And
yeah, that's a good point about, like you are interested in the things I'm doing, others are not. So we have a relation, we have such a relationship where you are, where disciples are interested in that, in the actual life of this person they've accepted as a spiritual master, not only the official role. Prabhupada once defined the word confidential. He said, when he was describing the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, he says, confidential means not everyone is interested. So only those who love Krishna are interested in the topics of ninth chapter and so on. So that would be why, to answer, getting back to your main question, to appreciate the poetry, I described in some of the problems somebody might have in poetry as a genre. But beyond that, I think people who may not even know, well, I don't know modern poetry from unmodern poetry, but you write about yourself and I like it. Your poems, you seem to write more about yourself, so I like it. So that would be a reason why people could appreciate the poetry, because I'm not just being an instructor, I'm being myself more. But others, there are others who don't want that. They feel insecure. They want the instructor to be always an instructor. And I can appreciate that, so they don't have to get into the poetry as much. Another thing is, this whole realm of my poetry being, or my writing being confidential for certain people. So then what, how do other people relate to it? Mainly they don't relate to it, they don't read it. And that's fair, just like we don't get into everything that everyone is doing and preaching all over ISKCON. But sometimes I've heard that people, this may be a little related to what you were saying, and perhaps particularly about poetry. Poetry is so vulnerable, it's so delicate, it's so personal. So some people say, well, I don't know if this is good for new devotees to be reading this kind of thing. I'm not exactly sure what they mean by that, but I think they have an image that a new devotee, he should just be programmed as to what Krishna consciousness is. He shouldn't be invited to start to admit that he thinks all different things, because he wants to get rid of that now. So there may be something to that. But then maybe I'm not writing for new devotees, or not the stereotype of what a new devotee is. But what is a new devotee? It's a lot of interesting people are becoming new devotees. And it's not that they will be harmed by this poetry. So I think whether it's new devotee or old devotee, some people will like it and some don't. And that's fine with me. I don't ask for more than that. There's a letter I got, I think is appropriate here, came from Bhakti Rasa, temple president in Newcastle. And he was just reading this writing in gratitude, and then he writes about a new devotee also. He said, I read this writing in gratitude, I'm inspired to write to you. I came across the poem titled, I Can Help, and immediately I feel a strong connection and empathy with what I want to say in this opening of my letter, and I feel able and allowed to speak to you from my renegade position. This is the beauty of you and your writing books, inviting people to associate with you and Prabhupada and Krishna from wherever they are at. I loaned one of our congregation called Ben the book Obstacles in the Path of Devotional Service the other day. He's an art student who draws and paints. Now he's drawing Prabhupada and Krishna, and he chants him rounds and tries to follow the principles. He told me I like his books. He goes on. So and that's something you, as a disciple, you have to just adjust. It's like you, it's not that you expect other Prabhupada disciples need to like these books and so on. As long as they respect that that it's an expression that it's for my disciples or friends and readers who do like it. And it has its space, it has its place in ISKCON. It's making a contribution to ISKCON. It's not a sign of decadence in ISKCON, it's a sign of culture. And it's got its place, that's all. And as in a larger society, the place is, you know, it's at the bottom compared to, you know, what's conceived of as what's important and what's going on. Poetry is never considered by most people to be a big thing, but it is.
You mentioned that there's so many poets in your line. You know, I'm not really so sure that I'm aware of Vaishnava poetry other than your own.
Well, it's a kind of a problem, because to appreciate it, you really have to appreciate Sanskrit.
I see.
And we're kind of like, cut off from our tradition unless you know Sanskrit. And even if you do, could you write in Sanskrit now? And who would be able to read it? When I say our line is poets, it's a Sanskrit tradition. I mean, Rupa Goswami, you see, he's a poet more than he's a philosopher. He's the Rasacharya, and he's written all these poetic books. They write in poetry. They write shlokas. They don't write prose. So literally speaking, they're poets. They're not prose writers. Rupa Goswami, Raghunath Goswami, even Jiva Goswami, he writes in poetry, writes philosophically. But everything is in shlokas. In their case, it is meters and rhymes. But metaphors.
Prabhupada wrote poetry to his Guru Maharaj on the absolute ascension that was proved.
I don't know much about Sanskrit poetry. Isn't it rhymes? Like Bhagavad Gita is rhymes?
It depends.
Not necessarily. Yeah. Not like English couplets or anything. But it's very strict. And Prabhupada makes fun. He said, not like your poetry, one line, 3 foot, the next line, 3 line, 3 miles or something. He said, it's all very strict laws, and so now it's quite the opposite in Kali Yuga. but at least the fact is there that they are poets. I think especially of Rupa Goswami in Narottam Das Thakur songs and so on. Those poets, the six Goswamis, more than perhaps some others. Oh, there's Chandidas, Vidyapati, Jayadeva Goswami. They were very beloved of Lord Chaitanya. Prabhananda Saraswati, he's a great poet of Vrindavan Mahi Mantra and poems. A lot of it is very confidential rasa poetry of Krishna and the gopis that we don't read for another reason. We're not qualified. But still, they're poems. They write beautiful poems.
And you were saying that it's necessary for a Vaishnava to be poetic just to get some way of expressing the transcendental pastimes and the transcendental features of the world. Is that a necessity?
Yeah, that's mentioned Ramananda Roy and Rupa Goswami in their talks. That's a very good literary chapter, that chapter in Antyalila where Rupa reads his poetry and Ramananda appreciates it. And Ramananda at the end, he says, this isn't poetry, this is a shower of nectar. And he said, what good is a poet? What good is an arrow unless it penetrates the heart? What good is a poet unless it makes you spins your head? So he said, actually, unless you can use metaphor, you cannot understand the pastimes of Radha and Krishna. So you just can't say that, you know, Krishna's got nice feet. But his feet are just so beautiful that you have to resort to poetry.
I remember in that quote that you about the arrow. What good is an arrow, or what good is a poem if it enters the heart but does not cause the head to spin?
Okay.
Consider.
Yeah, that's poetry. Verse.
That's real honest. I mean, that's real heavy.
Yeah. All the despair.
Uh-huh.
And then he comes up. Hell, he was a poet. A real poet. Bhaktivinoda Thakur was get up at midnight and would write poetry. So many poetry books and philosophy books also.
You said before that we're reading and writing Sampradaya somewhere where I was listening to. But you're also saying that it's not a writing class, you're not constructing people.
Right.
But what would you say about the value of if we could try to write, the value of that in developing our own qualities of honesty or whatever, Krishna conscious method?
Well, I prefer to answer that question like on a one-to-one basis. I wouldn't like speak it to you and mean it for everyone in the room. Just like we exchange letters, and it's all individual. So it's an individual thing, and I would try to find out what a person is saying. Usually I wait for somebody to say they're already doing that, and then if they're doing it, I encourage them. And I say, yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yes, it does that. And you can also try this, and you can do this. So it may be used, but it's not this necessary for everyone to do. It's quite late. I didn't know it was getting so late. Yeah. good sign, I guess, that we didn't notice the time. What?
The poem you wrote today.
Oh, yeah, I was going to read that. I was going to make the one last point about poetry, and this is an answer to your last question, that poetry doesn't, we could put it in these words, poetry doesn't seem to preach as directly as it talks about inner states. And I was saying, yes, it's not like propaganda, but poetry can be preaching propaganda too. So I wrote a poem today, and was able to make a few versions of it by Krishna Bhajan typing it.
And,
oh, okay. And so it's self-explanatory, although it's based on another poem that I read in a book. But it's not that you have to read that. To the author of, quote, "Pessimism in a Burger King in Minneapolis," unquote. I read a poem by a professor, Hunt Hawkins, "Pessimism in a Burger King." It was dreary. He sees restraint from killing as a sour philosophy that contemplates too much on evil, which the poet sees as inevitable and natural. Then, quoting from his poem, "Fuzzy thoughts of Nebraska feedlots filter through my head. Suppose the contents of this bun were somebody's mother," unquote. But he really doesn't mean it. Just a passing thought, lines for his latest poem, and quote again. "How I wish we all could become angels without stomachs," he quips. "But who is asking us to do that? Lord Krishna allows us to fill the belly and enjoy nice tastes without hypocrisy and unnecessary slaughter." Hawkins quotes sour Schopenhauer, who compares the little joy of the eaters with the big unhappiness of the eaten. Then his hunger and ignorance get the better of him, quoting his poem again. "But heaven is so far away. Lifting my burger to my face, I decide to embrace the tragedy of life and take a bite." Dear Hawk, here's the irony that escaped you, the tragedy you forgot. You'll have to pay for killing. You'll have to take the karma, you and all the folks who led you to this conclusion that it's all right to eat flesh, that there is no next life, no justice, only something you play with and call, quote, tragedy of life, unquote. You missed the point and so candidly exposed yourself as guilty. I've come to remind you, your better thoughts were the right ones. I wish you had pursued them. Don't kill. It's not necessary. God gives us a system to offer him harmless food in devotion. It's called prasadam. Please accept this food for thought. So we can preach directly to. Please accept prasadam.